We just wrapped up a great call with our friend Joe Roberts, who I found on X, formerly Twitter. And let me tell you, he came with a lot of great content to share about his business in real estate, land flipping, and cold calling. Lots of nuggets to share and a lot of motivation. Definitely something you guys should be paying attention to. Patrick, what'd you think about today's episode?
Today's episode really opened my mind to realizing that I need to be doing more than I am. I mean, this guy from a helicopter pilot stationed over in Afghanistan, you know, to building a 20-unit rental portfolio all while away, to coming home and within the last 6 months, starting two other businesses with land flipping and cold calling. I mean, he's absolutely crushing it, traveling around the country with his family in an RV. And man, it really inspired me. I know it's going to inspire you. Listen to the end, and here it is.
You're listening to the Real FI Podcast, where we discuss time-tested tricks, techniques, and strategies for pursuing financial independence today so that we can enjoy a better tomorrow.
A better tomorrow.
Financial independence isn't about getting rich quick. It's about cultivating a foundation to grow financially, mentally, physically, and spiritually. Let's figure out how to kick the 9-to-5. Here are your hosts, Patrick and James.
How's it going, everybody? And welcome back to the Real FI Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick McGrath, with my co-host, James Ripion. How's it going today, James?
Going well today, Patrick. I'm excited for today's guest because we came across them in a sort of non-conventional way. A lot of our guests we have apply directly to our podcast to come on. The rest of them we find through Instagram, but I've started to find that a lot of intelligent people are hanging out on X and Twitter, formerly Twitter. So that's where we found our current guest today, Joe Roberts. So I wanted to get Joe on to talk about the businesses he's got going on himself, rentals, land flipping, calling business. So without further ado, why don't we go ahead and introduce Joe. Joe, why don't you give our listeners a little bit of background about yourself and tell us what you're up to?
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for inviting me on. I'm excited to talk with you guys. So Joe Roberts, I just got out of the Marine Corps about 6 months ago, where I've been serving for the last 11 years since college. I was a helicopter pilot, Cobra Attack helicopter pilot in the Marine Corps. And then a few years ago, started investing in real estate when I realized that I didn't want to work for anybody else when I got out of the Marine Corps. And so I started building a path towards being financially independent my goal was by the age of 35. So I'm 33 now. So that'd be 2 years from now. Things went well, and I was able to accelerate that timeline. So I got out 6 months ago. I'm married. I've got 5 kids. My oldest is 9. My youngest is 1. And about a year before I got out of the Marine Corps, my wife and I decided that when I got out, since, you know, working for myself, I can really work anywhere I've got an internet connection, we would spend about a year traveling around the United States in a camper and homeschooling as we go. So that's where we are currently doing. Home base is North Carolina, but I run my companies from the road, and we are having fun exploring the U.S. So that's a kind of a brief synopsis on me and my background.
Man, I got to ask, how are you fitting 5 kids and the 2 of you in a camper RV situation without killing each other, going across the country? That's insane. Like, how does that work out?
Yeah, pretty easily, actually. I mean, it's big. Don't get me wrong. This is not like a little tent camper. This is a 43.5-foot fifth wheel. It's got a good amount of space, at least for a camper. It's got 2 porches, so there's a little bit of extra outdoor space. And we honestly just spend a lot of time outdoors, and we chase good weather. We stay where it's warm, so we're not cooped up in here. And yeah, I mean, we're in here a fair bit, but honestly, we're outside a lot. I mean, you can usually find me working on a picnic table at whatever campground we're at outside. So it will work. We definitely can get in each other's hair a little bit, but it's not too bad. We, you know, for me too, you know, I enjoy it even with the rough times. I had 3 deployments in my last 4 years in the Marine Corps, so I was gone a lot and I missed a lot of my kids' lives, so I'm happy to make up some time now.
Thank you for your service. greatly appreciate all of our veterans. And I'm sure that was a great experience, but right now you're catching up on, you know, some of that lost time and getting to spend this, you know, year plus traveling around the country with your kids, with your wife, creating these everlasting memories that I'm sure are going to have a huge impact on them. And you've been able to do that by making the right choices over the last couple of years, which I'd love to get into and kind of talk about that. Like what was it, you know, maybe what was it while you were deployed? Was it, you know, when you had some downtime that you started thinking about, you know, different ways to have a business when you got back? Let's dive into that a little bit.
Yeah. So it really was while I was deployed that kind of set everything off. I mean, we had a rental property that had been a primary residence when I was in flight school. And once we moved away, we just rented it out. So, and then we, you know, bought when we arrived at my first duty station. So we owned two homes. We were living in one, renting out the other. And real estate investing was something I was familiar with. My parents had some rentals growing up. My grandparents had rentals growing up. So I'd been around it, introduced to it, knew it was something that I was always at least dabble in. In 2018, I deployed to Afghanistan. And while there, very long story short, there was an incident that went off where myself and another officer basically got fired for doing the right thing. And that kind of basically set off some alarm bells to me just in the big picture, where it was like, okay, I've got a wife and three kids back at home. Obviously, doesn't matter that you if you're always doing the right thing, or you know, if you're working for somebody else, it really doesn't matter how well you do or how good you are. You're still ultimately your paycheck comes down to somebody else's decision. And so I was like, well, I don't want that to be the case anymore. I want to be able to, at any point I want, whether I'm still in the Marine Corps or I'm out and I'm working for somebody else, be able to walk away and say, I don't need this. I'm not going to compromise my morals for this, and not have my family's financial situation dependent on somebody else's decision. So I was there for 10 months. So I had a lot of time to read and everything. So that's what really got me interested in kind of building out a real estate portfolio. And when I got back, I started pulling the trigger on basically buying fixer-upper properties, renovating them, renting them out, refinancing, the classic, you know, BRRRR model that I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with. And so I worked on that for a couple years and built up a portfolio of rental properties.
Yeah, so how large were you able to build up that rental portfolio over the time that you were, you know, still employed with the Marines and serving the country?
Yeah, so I built it up from when I bought my first like pure investment property, not the one that I'd had from earlier. Bought that in late fall of 2019. And then I purchased the last rental property I bought summer of 2021. And in that time, I had 23 doors at one point. But when I purchased that last property, and it was 14 or 15 properties, I had some small multifamily in there.
Wow. So you went from basically two up to 23 within a 3-year span, 4-year span?
It was about 20 months.
20 months. So less than 2 years, you were able to acquire over 20 units.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's all with doing the BRRRR method.
Yeah, it was. Yep. And I deployed twice at that during that time.
While deployed twice,
yeah,
for extended periods of time. That is freaking amazing. So I'm sure a ton of the listeners out there are going, how in the hell were you able to afford to be able to do this? You know, was, you know, a helicopter pilot making that much bank? You know, where did you have some family help out? Like, is your wife rich? Like, tell us how you were able to do that. Cause some people are thinking, man, I can't even afford to buy one rental property in 2 years or three. And you were able to pull off this. So put some insight for the listeners out there on, you know, what was the secret sauce?
Yeah, I mean, so it started with essentially life savings. I somehow convinced my wife to liquidate basically all of our investments when I got back from Afghanistan, or actually while I was still there. And that was the seed money for the first property, which we purchased for $70,000, did just with essentially my life savings, basically a decade's worth of investments from dating back to when I'd started just socking away stuff in college. My wife had worked for a few days. She was a naval officer before she got out of the Navy. So, you know, when we were dual income for not very long, but a short period of time, we were socking everything away. And then we didn't really let lifestyle creep come into our lives very much. We basically lived on the salary of where we had been as a young second lieutenant or junior first lieutenant, even as I, you know, gained pay raises in rank. So we put a lot into savings. After the first few properties, obviously with the Burr method, that money can just keep churning, right? So that's one pot of money that just kept churning in house over house. Then we took on some family investors for essentially another pot of money that would go house to house. And I was doing them in around 3 to 4 months total, all in time from start to finish on a house.
Were these with hard money?
The family investments was just, I guess it would be kind of like hard money. Yeah, it was a fixed interest rate, a year loan from family that, you know, I essentially proved the model to them. I was like, hey, I did this with my life savings. Like, I bet on myself. I proved it before I asked for anybody else's money. And then they were happy to invest. So just did a flat rate. Basically, I gave, because I started a third pot of money with hard money. So I essentially had my life savings pot, a pot from investors, and a hard money loan. And I gave my investors the same interest rate as the hard money loan. I just didn't have the fees and kind of the other stuff to deal with. So it was a little bit cheaper. But basically those three pots of monies just kept rotating over from property to property as I built the portfolio. So at any one time, I would have 3 or 4 properties at some place in the process. Sometimes it got pretty tight. Like I'd be like refinancing and using that money to purchase like 2 weeks later. So I was backing them up as tight as I could.
So what was it like convincing your family members to kind of get involved with this? Was this something that you had to go out to them personally and on your own volition? Or were they just kind of seeing the success and kind of asking, hey, how do I get involved in this? Like what really transpired to get your family involved on the lending side of it?
Yeah, it was actually more of the latter. Like I was doing it and I was thinking about like, okay, I'd like to, now that I've kind of got some of my processes and systems down and I've got some of the people in place, the contractors I want to work with, et cetera. It's like, I can do more of these at the same time. And around that time, I got approached by some family that was, like I said, my family understands real estate. They have some of their own real estate. And so they've invested in syndications over the years stuff, so they understand like kind of how this stuff works, and they were like, hey, would you if we invested with you, would you take the money? I was like, yeah. So it was kind of right timing. If they hadn't asked me, I probably would have been asking them within a few weeks.
Makes sense. Now one of the questions that I do have is, you know, I know for me doing the Burr method, it was always a minimum of a 6-month seasoning period. So, you know, what were you doing specifically to be able to churn some of these over quicker than that? Or did you just have a couple projects going on where, you know, every 3 or 4 months, one was refinancing to fund the other one kind of thing?
Yeah. So at first, I had somehow missed that chapter, or I don't think that little fact gets talked enough about on the podcast and stuff. So it caught me by surprise on the first one I bought. So the first one I bought in a residential loan, the second one I bought in an LLC. So the LLC one was fine. I was able to work out a commercial loan. Residential one, I was like, oh crap, I got to wait 6 months. And I figured out a loophole. So what I started doing was I had the interest-free loan from my LLC as only a 12-month loan. A rate term refi can be done at any time. So I was doing rate term refis, using the money from the cash out refi to pay back the LLC and then use it for the next property. So I was able to cut my time at about half on the wait period.
Okay. So you kind of cut out there a little bit, but basically what I got was is that you essentially were taking a loan from your LLC to buy the property, and it was in your name. And then you would go and get financing for the refinance to purchase from yourself at the new appraised value, refinancing out of you, putting the funds back, and then paying your investors or whatever money with their percentage over top of that. Is that kind of what it was?
Exactly. The LLC pretty much just acted as a lender because a rate term refinance does not have a 6-month seasoning period. It can be done at any time. So by lending myself 0% interest rate loan for, you know, a year term, I could then do a rate term refi at any time I wanted.
That's amazing. So there you guys go. That is a sweet nugget. I've never heard of anyone doing that before. So that's awesome. I mean, I got sidetracked on a commercial deal that I was doing because my commercial loan was a year. So I had to wait 12 months before I was able to do that. And I should have looked at it in the beginning. 6 months would have been great because right at the time, interest rates, you know, I got 6%, which I'm happy for now. But, you know, I might have gotten like 5, 5.5 at the time if I would have paid attention or did something like that. So that is that's a huge nugget. And that sounds like that really helped you accelerate your growth.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have been able to do that without it. It was crazy. I just kind of stumbled across it because I was asking my loan officer. I was like, is there any way to refinance within 6 months? She's like, no, the only thing you can do is a rate term refi if you already had a mortgage on it. I was like, well, what if I put a mortgage on it from my own company? She's like, sure. So that's how it worked out. But yeah, it's crazy.
And that's really big too, because even if you buy the property in all cash, you still can't refi for 6 months. So by putting it in, buying it with your LLC cash as a loan, then you're refinancing the rate and term loan. But that's exactly. One thing that people don't understand either is that if you buy the property in all cash, if you go to refinance, all you're going to get is the purchase price before those 6 months. So that is an amazing workaround right there, man. I freaking love that. So what you were doing was, were these all essentially like small single family homes that you were doing long-term rentals with? Were they all kind of compacted in the same area? I mean, you're halfway across the world, you know, were you just buying up all over the place, or, you know, was it in the town that you lived in? Like, kind of break that down for us a little bit.
Yeah. So it was mostly single families, all long-term rentals, except my very last purchase, which was I turned into a short-term rental, but I actually just sold it almost exactly 2 years later. But yeah, everything other than that was long-term rentals. I did have 1 5 unit and 1 4 unit. So a couple small multifamily in there. And I was in about, I was in about 6 different markets, if you include like the rental in Florida. I had a rental in Atlanta, and then 4 different markets in North Carolina. The majority of it was clustered on the coast in 2 different markets, which was the Jacksonville, North Carolina market and the Wilmington, North Carolina market.
Okay. Looking back,
is where Camp Lejeune is, which is where I was based. So I was in that area when I was home.
Gotcha. And looking back on that, do you think that was a, you know, positive to your real estate strategy, having diversified in different markets? Or, you know, looking back, do you think you might have tried to concentrate it on one space? Because I, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, you know, there's probably a whole bunch of advantages from having them in different spots, but the biggest drawback is now you're interfacing with a whole bunch of different people in different markets, and that might be a lot to keep track of and stay on top of. So, you know, what are your thoughts with that?
I think now I'm happy I did it, and I would probably do it again. It's a trade-off, exactly what you said. It's a lot more people to interact with. And once you find a good team, it can be a slog to find that same team in a new market. But once you know how to find a team, it becomes a repeatable process. I ultimately am happy I diversified. into different markets. It definitely has its benefits. But yes, you know, interfacing with 5-6 different property managers is not ideal. And it's still something that, you know, to this day, I takes up more of my time because I still do have, you know, 4 different property managers I have to interface with, as opposed to maybe just 1 or 2. I'm willing to trade a little bit of that time for diversification though.
Gotcha. And are you still holding on to all those? You said you had 23 rentals. Do you still have all 23 or are you down to 22 after selling that?
So I sold the short term. I sold another one last year. And then I've got 2 more. One's going on the market. One's on the market and one's going on the market at the end of this month. So, and then I don't have plans to sell anything else. So, 4 single family homes I'll have gotten rid of in the last, year, when this is said and done.
What is the purpose behind that? Is it the, you know, return on equity? Is it that they're, you know, the least performing inside of the portfolio? Like, let us know where your head's at with that.
Yeah. So, the one last fall, that I sold to free up funds to start flipping land, to get some more capital. The short-term rental I sold this summer was really a decision. I don't see Airbnb. I don't see, Airbnb going to a good place. I don't see residential real estate going to a good place for a little while. And 2023, I've been down pretty significantly in revenue over 2022. And so I was just like, let me catch the top of this market, which maybe it's not the top, but I at least didn't catch any dip and made 100K off of it in 2 years. So, got out of that because, really that it was not doing well. No Airbnbs were doing well in that area. And then the other two were sold, one for mostly for tax reasons. It was previously a primary residence. And I'm coming up on the maximum amount of time I can be out of it for the capital gains tax. And so wanted to get that sold for tax reasons, but also that at the other one I'm selling because I want to, if I can, build the home, our forever home, with cash and not have a mortgage on it. And so I'm stocking up cash right now to do that.
Awesome strategy. I love that. And I you know, I see, even myself, you know, currently I'm like, should I sell some of these properties? Should I hold on to them? Can I deploy my capital somewhere else? Is there a better use for it? So I just, you know, love asking other investors who have let go of some things in the last year or two, why, or even putting stuff on the market right now, especially with the interest rates where they are, kind of to see where their head's at. And it sounds like, you know, you've got a good strategy with where that's going. So you're going to keep the 19 long-term rentals. Do you have any plans to buy any more long-term rentals given the current economic climate, or are you good where you're at and focusing your time on your other businesses?
No, I'm sure there's a scenario where I do, but you'd be hard pressed to find me buying ever again single family rentals, even small multifamily. Once I found land, vacant land, I didn't really look back at that stuff. I'll probably still invest in rentals at some point in the future, potentially if multifamily comes down to what I would consider more reasonable prices, maybe a mobile home park, something like that. But honestly, passive income from vacant land is so much more appealing than rental income from properties. I may not buy any more rental properties anymore.
Well, that's pretty incredible to hear, because it sounds like, you know, the single family, the rental space did pretty good things for your financial picture. You're having,
oh yeah, it did great.
You built up your net worth. You're going to be building your dream forever home, hopefully in the near future. So let's dig into this vacant land side of things, because that's kind of why I was interested to talk to you. I've been dabbling, you know, a little bit into the vacant land space a little bit. And it's very interesting, because you don't have tenants, termites, and all the other crap that goes along with dealing with, you know, the headache of short-term management with rent, Airbnb, or long-term tenants, evictions, all that kind of stuff. We all know the deal with that, what goes on with that side of real estate. So what got you into vacant land, and what was it about it that like really attracted you to it?
Yeah. So it's funny. So I was a speaker at the Bigger Pockets conference in 2021 in New Orleans. And when I was at that conference, I had already purchased what would end up being my last property, which was that short-term rental. I bought that thing off Facebook Marketplace, but I had already decided when I bought it, I was done buying single family. I thought the market was getting frothy. I was getting outbid because by flippers who are going to put lipstick on a pig, and I was getting outbid on everything. So I was just like, I'm done with this. So honestly, I went to that conference as a speaker talking about my single family portfolio and how I did it over well deployed and all that kind of stuff. But I was already kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing next. I just knew I wanted to do something real estate. Sat down at lunch one day with a guy named JT Olmsted. And, you know, we're just talking like, hey, what do you do? What do you do? He's like, oh, I flip vacant land. I'm like, flip vacant land. Like, what is that? He's like, yeah, I buy a piece of vacant land and then I sell it for hire, just like people flip houses. I was like, okay, tell me more. Anyway, JT is a fantastic guy. I bought him drinks that night and we sat down at the bar and he basically ran me through it. And I realized, because I had sourced some of my single family homes myself with off market direct mail campaigns, that sort of thing. So I was familiar with finding your own deals. And I was like, well, I could more or less take a lot of the things that I'm doing and just kind of modify them for vacant land and do this. And I was pretty excited about it. So that's what kind of got me into it initially. And it really wasn't too much of a switch to go from single family stuff. I mean, it's less when you think about it. I mean, everything's built up on vacant land. So it's just removing the buildings and stuff. Your due diligence is easier and it's a lot simpler to deal with.
That's so cool. That's really, really cool. So I want to dive into this a lot more because, you know, I'm sure we've had someone else on the podcast talk about this. James has dabbled in this too, like he said, you know, and the appeal sounds amazing. So this was 2021. Did you just like come right back and start mailing for vacant land? Like,
yeah, pretty
how
much.
How did this all start?
Yeah. Like, yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was, I was pretty busy. I was with Marine Special Operations at that time, and we were getting ready to deploy to the Philippines. We deployed in January of 2022. I mean, it was an intense deployment. So I knew it was going to be. So I knew I had to kind of get things set up and running before I got there so that I would be more in kind of manage mode than setup mode while I was overseas. So yeah, I pretty much came back, you know, picked JT's brain a couple more times and then just kind of revamped everything for vacant land and took off from there and started buying vacant land, via direct mail campaigns, and turning around and flipping it. And,
was your wife a part of this? Like, or did you have a VA? How are like the leads coming in while you're deployed?
My wife was not involved. I hired a VA to help me out and it got set up. But more or less, I took what I knew, the systems I had, and tweaked some things. And really the big thing was just getting a mail house set up, because I had been, for my direct mail campaigns, I had been hiring local people to handwrite cards, whereas for vacant land I needed to go out to a much bigger audience, and so I needed to find a mail house and kind of get that aspect set up, a phone number to take inbound calls, and was kind of off to the races at that point. And the VA was handling a lot of the tasks that I didn't have time for well deployed. You know, I taught her how to run comps and that sort of thing, and pull deeds and that kind of stuff, that the kind of tasks that need to be done, but doesn't need to be me doing it once I teach somebody.
So let's talk about your commitment to this shift in your strategy. What was your initial budget when it came to marketing? Because I know when it's, you know, this type of business, whether it's, you know, vacant land or wholesaling or finding off market deals, you got to commit a certain amount of money up front to really make it worthwhile to build your funnel. So, you know, what did that marketing commitment look like for you when you first got started?
It was pretty big. Direct mail is not cheap, especially having to do it at the amount that you have to do it for to find the kind of the right deals for vacant land, which is a big reason why I don't do direct mail anymore. But it was, I spent about 20 grand on marketing, I think, in the first 4 or 5 months that I was doing it. So it was a pretty substantial amount, and almost the entirety of that marketing was just mail. The tough thing about direct mail is you do have to buy in such bulk that you have enough data that the data means something when you get returns, right? Like if you only send out a few hundred letters, your data, it's not enough for your data to tell you anything. So you can't split test anything unless you're doing it at scale, but it's very expensive. So now if you send out a whole bunch of, like, my first letter was an absolute flop, and I learned from it, and that was all great, but it was a very expensive flop. And that's the tough thing about mail, is that it's an expensive way to split test.
So what are you doing now?
I only cold call now. So I had great success with mail last year, but I did see metrics really start to dip kind of last fall. And I was doing all sorts of split testing with various types of mail, different letters, different offers within the mail, and nothing was really kind of getting the same returns I had seen over the previous year. And so I just was decided, all right, well, it's probably not good that my business is built off a single form of lead generation anyway. So let's add something else here. Because at that point, you know, I was back for deployment. I was getting ready to exit the Marine Corps. I was going to be doing this full time to support my family. So I was like, this definitely needs to be treated like a real business. Now it's definitely, it's not a side hustle for my day job anymore. And so I just basically looked at my seller profile. I went through everybody that had responded to a piece of mail to me positively in the last year, and kind of mapped out, okay, what do these people look like? They're older. A lot of them didn't have cell phones. A lot of them didn't text. A lot of them lived out of state. They owned the property outright. So basically I was like, the best way to reach these people is probably to talk to them on the phone. And if it's not mail. So I that's how I hit on cold calling as a lead gen method.
I agree 100%. I've done some mailers, have not done any cold calling, but that's the exact demographic that I've identified. And I'm gonna talk to you about my pain point. How do you get these people to sign a damn contract? Because the last thing that they want to do is get on an email. Half of them do not use email. What is your strategy for dealing with some of those older landowners who might literally have a landline, and getting them to sign the contract and getting that back to you so you can go through the process and actually close?
Yeah, I mean, it's you got to make it easy for them. There's a letter sitting right up there that I need to drop off at the post office box with a contract in it and a prepaid envelope to send it back to me. So that's, you know, I do have to, any land flipper, I'd say, who's doing any sort of scale has run into this. Like, you are going to have people that they don't know what DocuSign is. They don't have an email, or they have it and they're like, nah, I ain't trusting that. So sending it to them, another good option. And I'm actually been moving more towards this, because even with the prepaid envelope to bring it back, you still have people that kind of flake out, or maybe they don't get it. Postal service is getting worse and worse, it seems like. So find a local public notary, send them the documents, set up and then coordinate a time between when the homeowner's there, and send the notary over with the contract, have the notary have them sign it, and then mail it back to you or scan it back to you.
That's a great tip right there.
Money tip right there. All right, now let's get down to brass tacks. Like, so you're telling us how great land flipping is, you know, that you went basically all in on this, and tips on how to get these contracts signed. But, you know, what are these deals looking like? Like, what is your average deal, if you have an average deal, really look like when it comes to purchase and then resale?
Yeah, I mean, so land flippers are all over the map when it comes to what kind of niche within land. Land's already a pretty small niche, but you can niche it down even further. And, you know, there's guys that do small infill lots. There's guys that do huge acreage and do subdivides and, you know, put improvements on it. I have been slowly working my way up the acreage kind of chain. So I started with relatively small rural acreages, you know, they're like 3 to 10 acres. I'm now up to, you know, 50 to 100 acre type size lots, still like rural acreage. I don't do infill lots in existing subdivisions. I don't do HOAs. But my typical deal, I mean, it's kind of hard to say, but I would say my average profit per deal is right around 25, 30,000. Maybe it's going up as I get, I'm doing larger and larger deals. And so that's bumping the average up. But especially when I was starting, I was very much in the like purchase for between 10 and 30K and then selling for like 30 to 80K type deals in that kind of range. So the goal in land flipping is getting harder. It's becoming a little bit more saturated even than just in the past few years since I've been doing it.
You know, do you think this is still a viable business model for you for the many years to come? Or do you think that this saturation is going to kind of, you know, fade away as we see some of these market changes that we're kind of experiencing right now?
I do think it's it'll stay viable. And I think that for a few reasons. So I think there's always a market for land, even in a downturn, vacant land. Now, the market may not be as high, but I think there's always going to be a market for land. The thing is that every other real estate asset is built off it, like we already said. So finding which land may work in a certain market is kind of where true operators are going to set themselves apart. But real estate is always going to be a thing. And the other thing is that the nice thing is, you know, purchase price points are much lower than any other type of real estate generally, obviously, because it's vacant land. So what that means is that you're able to kind of spread load yourself across more deals. And therefore, it's not as big a deal if a single deal doesn't work out the way you'd planned, because, you know, rather than spending $250,000 on a fixer upper house, if you have $250,000 to spend, you can buy, you know, 5 properties for 25K each and try to sell them for 40 to 50K each, you know. So,
and I think another good benefit to plan too is the holding costs. You know, you're likely buying with cash unless you have hard money somehow or private money. And very minimal, if any, need for insurance. And then taxes are going to be almost nothing because it's unimproved land. And that's what the majority of taxes are based off of, or the land improvements. So, right. You know, that does reduce a lot of risk in this business model.
It does. Yeah. So the big risk mitigation factors for me are, yes, holding costs are very low. And at least for me, the properties I'm buying, I've usually identified at least one other potential means of getting passive income from the land if I needed to, if I had to hold it, whether that's timber, potentially rock, hunting leases. I've done those before. So all stuff is, it's not going to make you a millionaire, but it'll pay the taxes if you need to hold this land for a while. So that's one risk mitigation factor, low holding costs. The second is how far below market value. If I'm paying cash for property, I'm getting it at a very steep discount, at a discount that I'm confident enough that if I needed to fire sale, I could turn around and probably recoup every cent of my capital that's in it. And the third is I've actually moved towards more of a wholesale model for a lot of my deals, especially if I can't get it at the price point I want. So a lot of times I'll approach a seller with 2 offers. I'll give them the, hey, I'll pay cash and I'll close in 30 days or less, 3 weeks, and it's this price. Or if you give me 120 days due diligence, you get this price, which is obviously a higher price. And that, you know, there's obviously clauses in there that allow me to market it. And so then I'll start blasting it out to my buyers list and starting to market it on social media and that sort of thing. So if I can't get it cash, buy it, turn it over to a realtor or whatever, then I'll market it myself while it's still under contract, just and wholesale or double close is what I typically do. So that's obviously huge risk mitigation, because the only thing I'm into the property is my overhead and $300 to send a photographer out there to walk the property.
I'm kind of blown away. I know we've, like I said, we've talked about this once or twice before, but it still amazes me you know, that just like vacant land can be that profitable if you have the right systems in place, if you're, you know, doing these things. So how many deals a month are you doing right now?
I'm averaging about 5 a month right now.
So 5 deals a month with your average of, you know, 25 to 50,000 all yep. per deal. That is amazing. And you've been all in on this for the last almost 2 years now?
Yeah, I wouldn't say all in. I mean, really all in time didn't come till I was out of the Marine Corps. But as basically my sole real estate focus, other than, you know, the managing my property managers on my rentals, yes, it's been vacant land's been the only thing I've been buying since summer of 2021.
That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible that you can create it.
We haven't even talked about the best part yet.
No, we're going to get there, but I'm just saying it's absolutely incredible that you can, you know, create a business, you know, travel all around the country with your kids, homeschool them and all of that, manage your properties and be able to have a business that's, you know, generating $100,000+ a month. And I haven't even heard the best thing yet. So what is
passive,
the best thing?
Passive cash flow. That was like the one big holdup I had when I was talking to JT that one night. I was like, okay, that's great, but I don't want to be a flipper. Like, I don't want my income to come from the next deal. Like, I want to be able to step away, not do any more deals and have income coming in. That's what attracted me to rental properties. And so that's where seller finance notes come in. So right now, I think right around 5 to 7,000 I have coming in a month in completely passive income from seller finance notes. At this point, it's as passive as could possibly be. JT, the guy I mentioned, he was a software developer in a previous life. He set up a website called yourlandloans.com, which is a payment portal for seller finance notes. And so basically, you know, I sell these properties, seller finance to folks. I'm trying to typically get my basis back with the down payment that they give me. Don't always do that, but I try to get it back with at least the down payment plus a year's worth of principal and interest. And all their payments are online into this portal, and it is direct deposited to me every month. I don't do anything. I don't own the property. I'm not responsible for taxes, for anything. I'm not responsible for anything except, you know, if they default, then I take the property back and resell it.
So, and I'm kind of curious about that because I've heard people going about it two ways. They call it seller financing, but one might be the rent to own way where they'll keep the title kind of escrowed and wait for all the rental payments to be made per the terms of their rental agreement. And then what you're describing, which sounds like legitimate seller financing, you're transferring title, you've got a lien position on the property, and you're collecting those payments. So, you know, how did you end up doing it the strategy that you're currently doing rather than maybe the rent to own way?
So two things about the rent to own. One, I never really got the allure of it. You're like, I don't want these properties. That's why I'm selling them. So why would I want to maintain title? The only reason you want to maintain title is if you think you're not going to get paid. Well, if you think you're not going to get paid, you probably shouldn't be selling it to that person in the first place. So to me, like the logic didn't really work out over there. Like vet your sellers or your buyers a little bit or enough to where you're confident you're going to get paid. Make it enough down payment to where they have skin in the game, and then just transfer title. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to be responsible for taxes if they, you know, they stop paying me. It's off my plate. It's theirs. So that was the big thing. A lot of those people that you see doing that, they're the ones offering a property for like, oh yeah, own this property for $100 down or $500 down. That's not my model. Like I said, I want my basis back with the down payment. And if not the down payment, then down payment plus a year's worth of payments. So, I would try to be free and clear out of my property when I frequently do double closings now where same day I'm buying it, I'm selling it, and I'm selling it into seller finance terms that same day. And it's just a note that's going on to the books. So it's just simpler and less headache to me to have title transferred. And then the only, if somebody defaulted, you have to go through the foreclosure process, which can take a little bit longer, but I honestly don't think it would come to that because all I would do is I would just go to them and say, hey, I don't want to foreclose on you. I don't want to ruin your credit. So how about deed in lieu of foreclosure? Just give me the deed back. We both walk away. So if it went down, I am fairly confident that's how it would go down. And if not, okay, I spend $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is to foreclose and get the property back. But again, my basis is out of it. I'm getting land that I don't have any investment in back at that point.
Gotcha. And I'm super impressed that you're buying the property, closing, and then you've already got your seller or your new buyer lined up, and you've got the seller finance terms, and you're able to just hit the ground running, from day one. That's pretty amazing and impressive. Have you found that the people who are looking for land really struggle to come up with the cash to purchase it? Because a lot of times, in my experience with what I've been dabbling with, a lot of times they're not very credit worthy. And then a lot of times they just have a hard time coming up with cash. So it sounds like your price points, might be at the level in excess of what I'm used to for people coming up with cash. So what has been in your experience there?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely those people out there that, want to buy your 20 acres and put $3,000 down on it or something. And I just tell them, hey, it's not the property for you. Most of my down payments are somewhere between 15 and 30K, probably 40K. So they're not small amounts of cash. So they're pretty serious buyers that are obviously serious about the piece of land that they want. So when I get those people that are like, hey, I've got $5,000 to put down on it, I'll either direct them to a property I might have that is typically much smaller and less valuable. And I'm accepting $5,000 down on that property. And I'll tell them, hey, that's what I've got. Or just, I don't think my properties are a good fit for you. But I don't want to be in the habit of selling somebody land who can't afford it. That's not a good place to be. It's not necessarily, I don't think it's very ethical if you knew somebody couldn't afford something and you're selling it to them. So I do some basic due diligence. At the same time, they're grown adults and people can make their own decisions. So I definitely, I'm not going over a year's worth of bank statements or anything when I'm vetting a buyer. If you're gonna, if you've got $30,000 to drop in cash on a down payment, proof of income and some other basic credit checks, and that's good enough for me.
That's right. That is definitely right. Now tell us about these seller finance notes. Like, what is your typical interest rate and term? Does that vary depending on how much they're putting down or the length that they're looking for? Like, what are these looking like?
Honestly, they're all over the map, because what I am really concerned about typically is how quickly I'm getting my basis out of. So I can do that any number of ways. And so I'm very flexible. I would say in general, they're putting somewhere around 20 to 30%, 20 to 40% down. Interest rates are typically around 10 to 13%, and that'll vary with how much they're putting down. Well, obviously, they put more down, I'll give them a lower interest rate. And then I don't do terms over 6 years because I'm not a bank and I don't want to still be collecting on something in 10, 15 years. But I will let them amortize longer if they want to. I very straightforward explain what the balloon payment's going to look like and everything. So I've got three-year AM loans. I've got 6-year term, 30-year AM loans. But I'd say my average interest rate is probably somewhere around 11.5 or 12%.
Okay. All with balloons. So,
not necessarily all with balloons. I'd say maybe about half of them, the term and the AM match. So, that's why seller financing, land flippers that don't offer it really do themselves a disservice, because they cut out a whole swath of buyers that are ready to buy land and have substantial amounts of cash put down as down payments and just can't find a loan because banks won't lend.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. So basically, they're buying the land from you with the intention to build, a dream house or a camp or something with that. And then they've got that finance with you. So then they're just going to the bank to fund the construction loan and not also the land.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Makes a ton of sense. Well, that is freaking super interesting. Now, are you doing anything else with real estate? I mean, you've got your rentals, you're selling stuff, you've got your vacant land. Is there anything else going on that you're involved in?
So I started a cold calling company. As I mentioned, I just started using cold calling as a source of lead gen for my land flipping business. And when I was getting started, you know, I wanted to outsource it. It wasn't something I'd proven the concept in-house. I had tried to hire some VAs, didn't work out great. Because I realized I was hiring myself as a cold call manager by doing that. And I didn't like that job and I didn't enjoy it. I wasn't very good at it. So it's like, all right, let me just outsource this. So I figured somebody was doing what Landcaller, my company, is doing. I was like, I'll just find them. So I reached out to some of the big names in the land community. He's like, hey, who's doing this? I want to hire them. Like, yeah, nobody's doing that. Everybody does direct mail. And it's true. Like a lot of people are adding text now, but 2 years ago, 95% of land flippers just did direct mail. And I think because it worked so well for so long is why things didn't really branch out. And so that basically just kind of gave me an idea. I was like, well, I want to do this. I don't necessarily want to do it in-house. So why don't I just start a company that will service my land business and then also provide this service for other land flippers. So I started Landcaller earlier this year in April with a partner. He's also a land flipper. And we've just been growing that company over these last 6 months, and it's kind of taken off like crazy, to be honest. It still blows me away every day how fast it's going, and more everybody's saying the same things, or most people are, that I saw in the direct mail space. It's expensive, it's slow, and it's getting saturated. And there's buyers out there that are best reached or maybe only reached by cold calling. And nobody's really ever tried to reach them before. So we're seeing a lot of interest in the land space for this lead gen method.
So it sounds like you've got, you know, three principal, you know, legs to your wealth building enterprise here. You've got the single family, you know, residential real estate, which you kind of, you know, maybe walking back a little from. You've got the land flipping operations business, and then you've got your cold calling service that you're also offering as a third-party service to other investors. Between the land flipping and the cold calling business, you know, what's kind of exciting you more? Where do you see more opportunity?
I also go back and forth on this on a daily basis. I like the land flipping more. I just really enjoy the hunt of a property, the hunt of a deal. When we're done traveling and settled down, I plan to get into more development than I have. And so the land company will be a good jumping off point for me to do that in Western North Carolina. And so I think that'll be my first love. The land caller honestly has, probably a higher ceiling. We're first to market. We've proven the market, and now there's a whole lot of people that are interested, and we're scaling as fast as we can. We just opened up a second center. My partner, who had a full-time W-2, quit his job 2 weeks ago to go full-time with the company. So, you know, we're up to over 30 employees. So there's definitely a higher ceiling there. I don't necessarily enjoy that work as much. But it's very exciting for me to be, you know, 6 months out of a W-2 and growing, you know, my own cash flowing business.
You know, I've always had that philosophy as well. A lot of people get into real estate thinking it's going to be their end all for their financial freedom, only to come, like, it doesn't move as fast as you think it's going to move. And the common theme of everyone we've interviewed has been the success is found with starting a business. Maybe it could be a business related to real estate, but you're generating massive amounts of revenue and from leverage. And in this case, you've got 30 employees calling for the benefit of other investors. And I'm sure you've got some sort of subscription model based on that. And, you know, that's going to feed your other real estate investments too. And in the future, your development opportunities. So, you know, I think it's not the easy thing to do either. It's starting a business. It's riskier. It's going to take a lot more time. Your partner probably gave up a more cushy, relaxed lifestyle with the W-2 to start what he's about to embark on, but it's going to be worth it at the end of the day. I mean, you guys are building something that's providing way more value.
Yeah, 100% agree. 100%.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all this is really, really great. I mean, the story is fantastic. What you've been able to build in such a short amount of time is wonderful and definitely inspiring. I know right now I feel like I'm definitely not doing as much as I should be. So I'm going to be kicking ass a lot more after this conversation, you know. But with that, like, what is the the goal here? Like, what is the goal for you? You know, is it you're already crushing it with all of these different things? You know, you got $5,000 to $7,000 in income, passive income with your land flipping business, plus you're making profit on top of that. You've got your 19 rentals, and now you've got this whole other thing going on. Like, you know, what's the goal?
Yeah, it's funny. I probably have a different goal than most of your guests or most people that are in, you know, real estate Twitter. Honestly, I want to retire. I'll never stop working, but you know, I want to get to my house, which is going to be the house I hopefully live in for the next 50 years. It's 21 acres on a river. I want to make it energy self-sufficient. I want to grow my own food, raise my own food. I'm a pretty simple guy. I was raised on a farm in Eastern Colorado, spent some time overseas as a kid because my parents were missionaries. But really, I feel a deep desire just to be on land with the land and live a pretty simple life. So I have entrepreneurial ideas all the time, but ultimately, I'm more interested in the free time I have to just kind of pursue things that I want and be there for my family. So I'll probably have a couple businesses throughout the years that'll, you know, keep things going. But I'm definitely not looking to be on the cover of Forbes or anything like that. Hopefully, my goal, honestly, is roughly 5 to 10 years from now. Nobody actually knows who I am anymore. I'm hopefully vanished from social media completely. If I have companies, I'm a passive owner, and I'm not out in the public space at all. Right now, I have to be to kind of build this business, but it's not necessarily where I want to be.
I love that. I love that. Freaking love that. And I think that this is a perfect segue into our last segment of the show that James and I call the Big Four. James, take it away, sir.
All right, Joe, tell us and our listeners something that you've done that's like a financial independence hack or a wealth building cheat code.
Man, I mean, we've already kind of talked about it, so it's cheating, but honestly, that for those that, you know, want to try the Burr method for building wealth, the ability to the velocity of your money is everything. So the ability to cut your wait time from 6 months to three is pretty huge. So I think that there's no way I felt the freedom to step away from the Marine Corps because my passive income from rentals had replaced my Marine Corps income, and it would have gotten there that quickly had it not been for my ability to do more deals in a year. So
love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. All right. Number two, we call this one resources. So are there any particular books, podcasts, or people that you're currently psyched up about that have changed your mindset, your business goals, your philosophies that maybe our listeners haven't heard of yet?
I would say so for the especially the land stuff, there's some courses and some gurus out there, but to me there's kind of one that stands above the rest. So anybody that's listening to this and is like interested in vacant land, you should check out Seth Williams and RE Tipster. His website, that was a big source for me when I was making the switch over, and I still very periodically go back to his website to check out new things and find new gems on there.
Gotcha. Perfect. Awesome. So, Joe, for this next one, this one's your future you. You can phrase it in terms of your personal life or with business. Where is Joe Roberts 5 years from now, either in personal life or with business?
Man, 5 years from now, I've probably got 10 to 12 head of cattle, a small herd of sheep. I get to fish with my kids in my river. I've got a house that I've hopefully largely built myself in the mountains of North Carolina, involved with my church, and own a couple businesses, and nobody except my family and friends knows who I am anymore.
Sounds like a wonderful life. Sounds like a wonderful life. Well, for anyone that wants to follow along on that journey, you know, reach out to the company. They want to call center for the land. They just want to reach out and tell you that this story's inspired them. And if they have any questions, where's the best place for them to follow along or get in contact with you?
Probably Twitter. I don't really do much social media, but I do Twitter, X. So that's definitely the best place. Landcaller.com is the name of the company or the website for the company. So you could find me there, or at Joe the Land Guy is my X handle, and that's definitely where I'm most active. My DMs are open, so hit me up on there and be happy to talk to you.
Perfect. Well, there you guys go. Go follow him on X, formerly known as Twitter. And you guys know the drill. If you enjoy conversations like this, if you get knowledge out of conversations like this, if you're inspired, if you're more motivated, and you feel that James and I are doing a good job bringing you new guests like this every week, please do us a favor. Leave us a review. Apple, Google, Spotify. Send us a DM. Tell us how we're doing. Give us recommendations for who you think that we should have on next. And with that, we'll catch you next time. See you guys.
See you guys.
Thank you for listening to the Real FI Podcast, where you learn from the investors that have lived the hard lessons for you. To connect with us during your pursuit of financial independence, be sure to join our community by following us on Instagram or emailing us at info@therealfi.com. If this content made you financially, mentally, physically, or spiritually richer, please make sure to leave us a positive review on your preferred content platform. Cheers to kicking the 9-to-5.